Well, doubt. We've been talking about doubt for a couple of weeks now, and we've kind of explored some heavy issues over the last couple of weeks. Doubt as it relates to faith. We've talked about doubting things like the Bible. You know, how can you trust that the Bible is something that can be read and relied upon, that it's authentic, even from God? We've talked about doubting God itself. You know, can you really trust God in the face of what seems to be such pointless evil and suffering in the world? We've talked about those things for the past couple of weeks. And what we've discovered is that doubt in and of itself is not a bad thing. Doubt can serve faith, much like antibodies serve the body. And when it comes to doubt and faith, there are some who would just fake it and pretend that doubt does not exist. And then there are others who go to the other extreme and just allow doubt to completely overcome them and can't get out from under the shadow of it. Well, today we're going to continue talking about doubt and faith and how the two go together, but from a different angle. This morning we're going to talk about this. What do you do when the doubts that just seem to overwhelm, what do you do when those doubts are not your doubts? What do you do when it's someone you know who cannot escape the shadow of doubt and you want to help them escape from that shadow? That's what we're going to talk about today. Now, before we do that, before we get into all that, just let me say off the front, I was not made aware of the five kind of prerequisites in order to teach here. I will do my best to abide. Now, it's going to be quite easy to acknowledge that my ninja skills are nowhere near that of Pastor Jerry Gillis. I think that's obvious to all of us. I will do my best not to pepper this thing with y'alls all morning. Won't make any promises, but I'll do my best. As for the whole Georgia football thing, you know, not acknowledging that my team is superior to that, I'll go along with it only because I know that the Lord knows the truth. All right? So we'll just stick with that and we'll move on. All right, doubt and faith. Hey, let me ask you a question. Have you ever seen something that just stood out like a sore thumb? It just didn't really fit the landscape that was around it. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Look at this picture here. Now, we're familiar with this, right? Obviously, this is Mount Rushmore. Anyone ever been to Mount Rushmore? Who's been there before? Yeah, a lot of folks been there in South Dakota. I've never been there. Now, imagine this. Imagine that you were unfamiliar with Mount Rushmore. You did not know this thing existed. And let's go one step further. Imagine you didn't recognize the faces of the presidents. They just didn't ring a bell. So one day you're driving along through South Dakota, as we all do on occasion, and you're just admiring the mountains and the nice landscape and the trees, and then all of a sudden, there's this. I think it's safe to say it would capture your attention, would it not? I mean, you can't just look at that one time and then just keep driving and say, yeah, that was interesting, or what? You know, I didn't even notice. It would capture your attention. It would make you look twice. If it was me, I would probably stop and flag somebody down and say, what in the world? I mean, what's the deal with the big faces on the mountain? It just doesn't fit in. It just doesn't look like the rest of the stuff. Here's another one. Check this one out. Now, what's the name of this place? Stonehenge. Yeah, out in the Wiltshire County of England. Anyone ever been there? Yes, hands. Wow, I'm impressed. Now, Stonehenge. You're walking around looking at the grass, right? I mean, it just looks like a nice big backyard, and then there's this. Again, it would capture your attention. It wouldn't really fit in. Now, let's up the ante a little bit. We know Mount Rushmore. We know Stonehenge. Who can identify this place here? Anyone? Easter Island. Very good. Easter Island, way out in the South Pacific, away from, you know, everything else. Now, I've been on an island before, but I promise you I was not greeted by large heads of stone, all right? It just doesn't look right, does it? It's weird. And you go to Easter Island, and they've found like 800 of these things, which truthfully is quite creepy. But you see a theme here? Do you see a theme? We're looking at rock formations or stones that are odd. They're strange. And of course, some stones are much stranger than others. Yes. If that doesn't force you to stop and take a double look and ask some serious questions, nothing will. But stones that really stand out, whether it's the U.S., whether it's Europe, where it's, you know, wherever, Egypt, you name it, people have been building these monuments for the purpose of getting someone's attention. Now, why have they done that? Well, everyone who's done this had something to say, something they wanted to communicate, words that they wanted to express. So instead of just saying the words, they built a picture. Because a picture is worth what? 1,000 words. So all throughout the ages, people have had things they wanted to say, and to help them express those things, they've provided a visual. Now, in the time in the land of the Bible, in the ancient East, it was no different. Israel and her neighbors oftentimes expressed themselves through pictures, through stone monuments. Let me show you this picture of one, and I promise this will be the last picture. I know it's like, you know, seeing somebody go on vacation, they come back and make you look at a bunch of pictures. These pictures here were taken in a region named Gezer, which is kind of right in the heart of where the Bible activities took place. And these are some recent photographs, stones that are still standing from thousands of years before. And these stones are interesting on several levels to me. One is just they're huge. Some of these stones are 20 feet tall and go several feet into the ground. Not an easy task. And when you consider that most believe that these stones were carried from a pretty good distance and placed by this road so that when people would pass by, they would see them and a story would be told. Now, the question I have is why? Why would someone go through all that trouble to haul these stones up a hill, put them in a place just so people could see them? The reason why is because someone had a story to tell. And in the ancient East, where Israel was located, the stones often had religious connotations to them. People put stones up to tell stories of faith so that when those would pass by and would see the stones, they would ask questions. And maybe these were people who had doubts about issues of faith, and the stones would help them tell the story. Here's what we're going to do today. I want to ask you to get your Bible out. We're going to look at a couple of different instances in the Old Testament where people use stones, the Israelites more specifically, use stones to communicate something of significance in regard to their faith, in regard to God. And then we're going to come back full circle and talk about what that means for us. So Genesis chapter 28 is where we're going to begin. Now, before we get there, let me say this. If you're new to the chapel, maybe new to church altogether, and you didn't come prepared with a Bible, that's no problem. There are some located throughout the seats. You just grab one of those, or you can have someone pass one down to you. If you don't have a chance to do that, you can just follow along on the screens. But Genesis chapter 28 is where we're going to begin. Now, before we read it, let me kind of set the stage so we know what's going on here. In Genesis chapter 28, we're going to read about the events surrounding the life of a guy named Jacob. Now, Jacob is a pretty familiar name in terms of the Old Testament, kind of one of the founding fathers of the faith. So when you hear the name Jacob, you think, okay, Bible hero, you know, great guy, whatever. As you begin to read the story of Jacob, it becomes evident this is not your typical Bible hero. I mean, here's a guy with some serious character flaws. As a matter of fact, when we're first introduced to Jacob, we're told that he was the younger of two twins. He was the little brother. Now, that's not that big of a deal. I'm a little brother. But in Jacob's world, it was kind of a big deal if you could be the older brother. See, the oldest son in a family had all kinds of rights and privileges that no one else would get. For example, the oldest son would get what was called the birthright, which basically meant they would get like a double inheritance when dad died and those kinds of things. So it was a big deal if you could be the older brother. Well, in the narrative telling us of Jacob's birth, we're told that he was the younger of two twins. The older twin, Esau, was born first. And then we're given this picture of Jacob being born second, holding on to the foot of his older brother. It's kind of a funny visual picture, a picture of one who perhaps just wants to be first, who wants to have what's not his. Now, to make matters worse, his parents name him Jacob, which in their language meant deceiver. So, you know, that's a nice thing to carry around with you as you're, when you're a kid, right? First day of school, what's your name? Deceiver. You know, you make a lot of friends that way. Well, Jacob, the deceiver, as his life unfolds, we see him living up to his name. As a matter of fact, there's this one instance where Jacob's dad is getting old. You know, he's well in years, and it looks like he may die soon. So what does Jacob do? He takes advantage of his dad, completely manipulates the situation, completely maneuvers circumstances, takes advantage of his brother Esau and manipulates him so that Jacob ends up stealing the birthright from his brother. Tricks his dad, gets his dad to give it to him. It's not a good situation. Really kind of a low thing to do. Would you agree? Well, as a result, Jacob has to run for his life. You know, he's afraid that Esau, his older brother, is just going to kill him. Nobody at home's happy with him. So he just takes off and runs. He's going to go out in hiding. This is where we pick up in the story in Genesis chapter 28, a deceiver on the run, just trying to get away. So Genesis chapter 28, let's start reading in verse 10. You just follow along as I read. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. And when he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. And taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to the heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And parenthetically, by the way, I believe, just a little historical tidbit, Jacob got out a pen and paper here and actually wrote the song Stairway to Heaven. So just for those of you who didn't know, that's where that took place. Kind of neat, huh? All right. So this stairway going into heaven, angels going up and down, verse 13. There above the stairway stood the Lord, and he said, I'm the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you'll spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. And I'm with you, and I will watch over you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place. And I was not even aware of it. He was afraid, and he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. But this is the gate of heaven. And early the next morning, Jacob took the stone that he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, meaning the house of God, even though it used to be called Luz. So here's the story. A deceiver on the run, a guy who certainly has not honored God with his life, on the run because he's done something really bad, stops for the night, and all of a sudden, God shows up. Now, if you're Jacob, what are you thinking? Oh, brother, I've been caught. I've been busted. Instead, God gives him a very gracious message. He says, Jacob, I realize you're on the run. Here's the deal. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to keep you safe. And in the process, I'm going to bless your socks off. At this point, God has gotten Jacob's attention. It makes sense, doesn't it? Well, over the years that transpires, the pages unfold, God continues to get Jacob's attention. There's this one instance in chapter 32 where God and Jacob actually meet again, this time in a physical sort of a way, where God and Jacob kind of wrestle together in a physical sense. Now God really has Jacob's attention. Shortly after this, Jacob runs into his brother Esau. You remember Esau, the guy he stole the birthright from, the guy who's probably going to wring his neck and kill him? He runs into Esau. Guess what happens? God has softened Esau's heart. Two of them are reunited and reconciled to one another. So God has been incredibly gracious to Jacob throughout the process. Now, sometime after that, years later, God and Jacob meet up again. Look at it with me. It's in chapter 35 of Genesis. I want you to see what happens. God shows up again, and here's what happens. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 35. Then God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel and settle there, live there, and build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, get rid of the foreign gods that you have with you and purify yourselves. Change your clothes. Then come, let's go up to Bethel where I'll build an altar to God who answered me in the day of my distress and who has been with me wherever I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods they had and the rings in their ears, and Jacob buried them under the oak at Shechem. So here's the deal. God tells Jacob, he says, head on back to Bethel. Remember that place where we met? Remember the place with the dream and the ladder? Go back there and set up shop. God has promised Jacob that he would protect him, that he would be with him, and he's done that. He's promised Jacob, I'm going to give you descendants. We see that unfolding. Now God says, why don't you go back to the place where we met, to Bethel, the house of God, the gate of heaven, and just live there. So Jacob tells all of his entourage, his family and his big posse, he says, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go back to the place where God is, where I met him. We're going to live there. And if you have anything that doesn't honor God, you have idols from other gods or whatever, get rid of them. Better yet, just bring them to me and I'll bury them under the tree. And that's what he does. So they head out back to Bethel. Now check this out, picking up in verse 9 of the same chapter. It says, after Jacob returned from Paddan Aram, God appeared to him again and blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Now what does Jacob mean? Deceiver. Hey, a reminder, buddy, you're a deceiver. But you will no longer be called deceiver. You'll no longer be called Jacob. Your name now will be Israel, which means one who wrestles with God, one who tangles with God, one who is intertwined with God. That's your name now. So he named him Israel, verse 11. And God said to him, I'm God Almighty. Be fruitful, increase in number. A nation and a community of nations will come from you, and kings will come from your body. The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I also give to you, and I'll give this land to your descendants after you. Then God went up from him at the place where he talked with him. So look how Jacob responds. Jacob set up a stone pillar at the place where God had talked with him, and he poured out a drink offering on it. He also poured oil on it. And Jacob called the place where God had talked with him Bethel. So here's the story. A deceiver is a deceiver no more. God takes him, rearranges him, even changes his name. God shows him grace and blesses him. God does in Jacob's heart what no one else could do. So how does Jacob respond? Well, he responds like any of us would. He'd set up a pile of rocks, all right, to tell a story. Anyone who ever came down this road again, Jacob wanted them to take notice that something odd was on the side of the road. Jacob wanted his story to be told. And the story that he had to tell was this, that God can and God will do the miraculous in the life of a person. That was Jacob's story. For generations to come, Jacob wanted people to know that there is a God who can do the miraculous in your life. There's a God who can intervene and transform you. And Jacob saw himself as living proof. Now fast forward with me to another story. I want you to skip over the book of Joshua. I want us to look at another story here, about five books over. Joshua chapter 3. Just flip over there about five books. Joshua chapter 3. Now as you do that, let me give you a little background on this one too. Joshua is now the leader of the Israelites. This is years after Jacob. Remember, God promised Jacob, you'll have a lot of descendants. And God also promised Jacob, you will have a home to live too, a place I'm promising you. As we come to Joshua, we see this kind of unfolding. There are tons of descendants of Jacob now. Joshua is their leader. They find themselves on a riverbank, the Jordan River. On the other side of the river is the land that God has promised to them. All they have to do is walk over there and get it. But there's a couple of problems. First, the river's at flood stage. It's impossible to get across. Even if you could get across, people now live on the other side of the river. They've made that their home. If you go over there and say, this is my home, it could get pretty ugly. So God says, look, just trust me. Just go to the other side, and I'll take care of all that mess for you, okay? He says, here's how you're going to get across the river. Take the Ark of the Covenant, which was a holy thing that the Israelites used to worship. It's a place where God would manifest himself and kind of make his presence known. God said, take the Ark of the Covenant, have the priests carry it, and just have them walk into the river. Sounds like a pretty good deal, right? Unless you're the priest. So Joshua says, here's the deal, guys. We're going to cross the river. This is an entire nation of people. We're going to cross the river, and here's how we're going to get there. The priests are going to lead us. So when the priests go, we'll just follow. All right? So let's look how the people respond. In Joshua chapter 3, look at verse 14. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during the harvest. Yet, as soon as the priest who carried the Ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan. While the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, that is the Salt Sea, it was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all of Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. So you get the picture? The priests step into the water, this raging river. It stops, piles up. Everyone walks through with these priests just standing in the middle of the river. God had done the miraculous, and it was miraculous on several different levels. The water in and of itself is miraculous, but think about this. It's an entire nation of people all agreeing to do this. You ever tried to get a bunch of people to do the same thing? And think about this. Years earlier, under Moses' leadership, they were in the same place with the same instructions, with the same God, the same river, the same everything. And God had told them, just cross the river and go take your land. And an entire nation turned back to God and says, no way, no how. We'd rather just disobey. We'd rather be defiant because we don't like the way this is playing out. Now, years later, an entire nation with a completely different heart, completely different willingness to obey God. A people who had been defined by disobedience were now being defined by radical obedience to God. They crossed the river. Now look how Joshua responds. Look in chapter 4 in verse 4. So Joshua called together the 12 men that he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and he said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. And in the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. And these stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of Israel, as the Lord had told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to their camp, where they put them down. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. So here's the story. Joshua, like Jacob, saw God do something, miraculous, and as a result, he wanted the story to be communicated. And to make sure that the story was communicated for years to come, he takes 12 stones and piles them in a heap. He says, in the future, when people walk by, when your children walk by and say, whoa, that's weird. Why are these stones piled up by the river, Dad? He says, you be sure to tell them the story. What did he want them to hear? He wanted them to hear this, that God can and will do the miraculous for an entire community. Whereas Jacob saw God overhaul his life, Joshua saw God overhaul an entire nation of people. And for years to come, the story was to be told. So Jacob, Joshua, guys who set up monuments, standing stones they would call them, to help them tell the story of faith, so that for years to come, when people would walk past Bethel or people would walk down the Jordan River, people who perhaps doubted God and his power, they would hear the stories that there is indeed a God and that he is quite strong. It's what the stones did. Now, it's interesting. The people of God, all throughout the Old Testament, you see people setting up these monuments of stone to tell the stories of God and his power. Then we come into the New Testament, and the church is established, and I don't really see them doing this much anymore. I mean, I think it's interesting. For years and years and years, people have been constructing stones to tell the story of God and his power. Yet you come to the church, and you don't see it a whole lot. Why is that? Well, I think the Apostle Peter helped shed some light on it. See, Peter was one of Jesus' closest companions, one of the original disciples, walked right alongside Jesus. And Jesus and Peter emerged as one of the leaders of the early church. The church found themselves surrounded by doubters. The church carried a gospel, the gospel that Jesus could save, that Jesus was strong enough to actually change the human heart. The people around them doubted that gospel. So Peter writes them a letter with some instructions. And listen to what he says. This is found in 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 4. Listen to what he says. As you come to him, Jesus, the living stone, the one who was rejected by men but chosen by God and precious to him, now you also, like living stones, are being built up into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. Hear what Peter just said. Peter just said this. He says, those who believe in Jesus, those who follow Jesus, are supposed to be so different, so strange. He says, you know what you are, church? He says, you're a standing stone. No, better yet, you're a living stone, a monument of God who goes from place to place, conveying the story that there's a God who's powerful enough to transform the human heart. He says, and the way that you live is supposed to be so different that just like Stonehenge or Mount Rushmore, people should take a look at you and stop and take a second look and say, now that is different. That's odd. It's strange. It's just different. Now, let me say this. The church, oftentimes, in an attempt to be countercultural, oftentimes we're just weird in the wrong way. Sometimes we attempt to be different strictly by outside things. Maybe the way we look or the way we cut our hair or whatever it may be, the music we listen to. Peter's talking about something much deeper than that. Much deeper than that. Listen as he goes on in chapter, in the same chapter in verse 9. He says, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his wonderful light. For once you were not a people, but now you're the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So, dear friends, I urge you, as aliens and strangers in the world, to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us. Here's what Peter's telling us, folks. He's saying being countercultural, it's not about external things. It's not about the outside stuff. It's about being. It's not about looking different. It's about being different. And that's a fundamental difference, folks. We are to be living stones that are so different that the world around us cannot help but stop and take notice. Say, what does that look like? It looks like this. It means that we are so forgiving that it's just plain weird. It means that we are so generous, it's just odd. That in a world where vengeance is the norm and getting back is the norm, we are incredibly eager to turn the other cheek. In a world that's about getting everything you can, we seem to be more than willing to give our own stuff away. That in a world where perversion is the rule of the day, that we seem to be incredibly pure people. Peter says, be so different on the inside that people can't help but take a second look. That's what it's all about. Here's the bottom line, folks. Here's the truth for the day. This is what I want you to remember. Transformation is hard to doubt. Transformation is hard to doubt. Listen, I can give you arguments as to why I believe God exists, and I think they're good arguments, but you know what? You can argue back. I can argue with you why I think that the Bible is reliable and dependable. You can argue back with me. I can argue as to why I think you can trust God, even though there's what appears to be pointless evil and suffering in the world. You can argue back, but I'm going to tell you what you cannot argue with. God has changed my heart. He just has. He's made me different. And I have no other explanation than the fact that God has done it. Transformation is hard to doubt. And in a world of people who are looking for answers, a world of people who are wondering, is this Jesus thing for real? I'll tell you what will convince them beyond anything. When they see a people who've been transformed. They see a people who've been transformed. A picture is worth 1,000 words. You want to convince your friends and family that Jesus is for real? Show them a picture of redemption at work. Show them a living testimony of a changed life. Peter went on to say this in chapter 3. He says, "But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have." You know, Peter makes an assumption here. As you read through it, Peter makes an assumption that the Christians are being asked. He says, hey, when the world takes notice of you, of your peculiarity, of your oddness, the fact that you're different on the inside, when they notice that, be sure to answer them when they ask about it. Here's the question I think we all have to ask ourselves this morning. When it comes to my life, is anyone asking anything? Is the way that I'm living my life demanding that people stop, take notice, and ask some questions? When they do, I have the opportunity to tell them the simple message that there's a God who's changed my life. If nobody's asking me anything, perhaps it's time I get serious about transformation. And here's what I want to do this morning. Perhaps for you, it's time to get serious about being transformed. It's time to get serious about being a living stone in this world, a living testimony of the power of God. Here's what I want to do this morning. I'm going to put a couple of things in your hand that I want to help you. If you're serious, if you want the love of God begin to radiate through you to a point where people are going to take notice, here are a couple of things I want to put in your hand. Inside your bulletin is where they both are. Let me point them out to you. You can just get them out. On the little page where you can take notes today, it's a little piece of paper like this. On the back side is a section that's going to help you this week spend time with God. Praying, reading the Bible. And just let me say this. If transformation is going to take place in your life, the kind of transformation that brings about real Christ-likeness, the kind of transformation that really does bring about peace and love and joy and patience and self-control and all those kinds of things that make a difference, you're going to have to spend some time reading your Bible on a regular basis. So, good news, right here, you take it with you. And here's my challenge for you this week. I want you to spend time with God praying and reading your Bible every single day this week. Every single day. Not just wait till next Sunday, not just kind of every other day, every single day, okay? So if you're serious about living the transformed life, this is one piece of the puzzle, okay? So I want you to take this home. I want you to use it. Now here's another one. Inside your bulletin is this little card you'll see. Kind of a colorful card about this size, exactly this size. On it, there's a section that says get involved in an adult small group. If you really, really want to get serious about seeing Christ-likeness being produced in your life, I want to strongly encourage you to get involved in a small group. You say, what do I need to do? What is that? It's a small group of people who meet together periodically to help us grow in Christ-likeness together. That's pretty much it. All you have to do is take this card, fill it out, and then in a few weeks later on in September when these new small groups are being formed, someone will contact you. Tell you what to do, where to show up. It's that easy, okay? You really want to get involved in transformation. Take this, fill it out. I'll give you some instructions in just a moment. Now, one last thing. You flip it over. There's one other thing. My place to serve at the chapel. In here are places where you can volunteer here at the chapel, get involved in ministries. You might say, what does that have to do with personal transformation? I'm going to tell you it has everything to do with it. You want the world around to take notice? Do you remember how Joshua, there was an entire nation of people all working together in unity? What if we as the chapel body on Sundays were known not as people who showed up and soaked, but people who showed up and served? It would leave a tremendous testimony to those who came. And if you have friends and family who aren't sure what your faith is all about, and you want them to begin asking questions, just volunteer to work with middle schoolers. That should evoke some questions. Take this, fill it out. When you leave today, you can hand it to an usher. You can turn it in there. You can lay it on any of the tables outside in the foyer area. We'll get those and we'll take those and process those, okay? Listen, transformation is hard to doubt. It's time to get serious about it. Hey, let's stand together. I want to share one last word with you as we get ready to dismiss, an encouraging word. And you don't forget as you leave, you take those Bible study plans, you read them this week. You take those volunteer cards, those small group cards, you fill them out before you leave today. You turn them in when you leave. And if by chance you're here today, you've never fully committed yourself to be a follower of Jesus, you've never really had that defining moment in which you gave yourself fully to Jesus, but you're curious about what that means, I want to personally invite you right after church in the fireside room, right through those back doors across the way. You come in there. I'll be there. Some other pastors will be there. We would love to talk with you, point you in the right direction. So if it's your desire to be a follower of Jesus, you've not yet come to that point, please come over there and let's talk. We'll point you in the right direction, okay? Until then, those of us who are followers of Jesus, let me dismiss you with these words. You are a chosen people. You're a royal priesthood. You're a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of Him who called you out of darkness and into His wonderful light. God bless you, folks. Let's go out this week and be living stones. You're dismissed.